Station. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, ideas, what have you, at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jill Freitas, Catherine Carley, Alex Gonzalez, Shantia Hudson, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of evening news is the effervescent Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. By the way, all of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great people like you. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join us because we can't do it without you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. Have a great night.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. The Nobel Peace Prize goes to an Iranian woman. China charged in the U.S. fentanyl crisis. And the Hamas attack on Israel. The Nobel Peace Prize. Narges Mohammadi, an Iranian activist who is serving a 10-year sentence in an Iranian prison, received the 2023 Nobel Peace Prize last week. Quote, for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran and her fight to promote human rights and freedom for all, according to the Nobel Committee. She was a major voice in the huge anti-government protests last September, when the UN estimates around 20,000 people were arrested. The motto adopted by the demonstrators, Woman, Life, Freedom, suitably expresses the dedication and work of Narges Mohammadi, said the Nobel Committee. This year's Peace Prize, it said, also recognizes the hundreds of thousands of people who, in the preceding year, have demonstrated against Iran's theocratic regime's policies of discrimination and oppression targeting women. Mohammadi has written, quote, we are fueled by a will to survive, whether we are inside prison or outside. The government's violent and brutal repression may sometimes keep people from the streets, but our struggle will continue until the day when light takes over darkness and the sun of freedom embraces the Iranian people. Almost needless to say, the Iran government's response to the award was to accuse the Nobel Committee of being a tool of Western countries. But that didn't stop the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres from praising the award for being, quote, an important reminder that the rights of women and girls are facing a strong pushback, including through the persecution of women human rights defenders in Iran and elsewhere. Chinese companies and executives are charged on the fentanyl trade. An undercover U.S. operation in which agents ordered chemicals from China that are used to produce fentanyl has led to criminal charges against 8 Chinese companies and 12 executives. It's the second such action against Chinese companies. We know who was responsible for poisoning the American people with fentanyl, said U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland in a speech. And we know that this global fentanyl supply chain, which ends with the deaths of Americans, often starts with chemical companies in China, he said. These precursor chemicals are typically sent to Mexican drug cartels, which synthesize the chemicals into finished fentanyl for distribution in the U.S. As many as 110,000 American deaths are attributed to fentanyl and other synthetic opioids, making it the biggest drug epidemic in U.S. history. The U.S. Justice and Homeland Security heads are in discussion with Mexican leaders about how to rein in the China cartel connection, but prospects for serious cooperation with Mexico are rated poor. Meantime, U.S. officials are not talking with Chinese leaders about the fentanyl trade. Those talks collapsed some time ago. That's too bad, since back in 2019, one just-published study says, quote, China began to place restrictions on the entire class of synthetic opioids and even worked together with the U.S. on drug busts. Now that U.S.-China relations are very tense, China's willingness to cooperate has evaporated. As this writer states, quote, China views the fentanyl crisis through the lens of its growing rivalry with the United States, unquote. That leaves the U.S. with sanctions as the next best strategy, a choice bound to be far less productive than improving relations with China. The Hamas attack on Israel. Once again, Israel and the Palestinians are at war. Hundreds are dead, thousands are wounded, Hamas has taken hostages, and Gaza is under siege. Hamas claims the attacks in the Gaza Strip are in response to denial of access to the holy site known as the Aqsa Mosque to Palestinians and to the Israelis as the Temple Mount. But it's far more than that. It's about the occupation and Israel's blockade of Gaza for the last 16 years. A Palestinian professor in Gaza writes, quote, instead of reacting to one of apartheid Israel's regular genocidal attacks, the resistance movements have taken the first step in an unprecedented move. Enough is enough. The resistance movements in Gaza, right and left, have decided to turn the table upside down. They have given the Palestinian struggle a new impetus, a clear direction toward liberation and decolonization, unquote. Such defenses of Hamas ignore the atrocities that have been committed, the innocent families and towns that have been wiped out. The Netanyahu government considers the country at war and the attacks perpetrated by terrorists, not resistors. It's Israel's 9/11, people are saying, but if so, Netanyahu is committing the same error George W. Bush made, using a surprise attack to launch an all-out war rather than limit the response to going after the assailants. He vows to destroy Hamas's grip on Gaza by laying siege to it. Indiscriminate Israeli attacks on civilian targets are occurring, setting the stage for future violence. The Biden administration's response endorses Israel's right to defend itself and its people, full stop, said the president. There is never a justification for terrorist attacks, unquote. But neither is there justification for abandoning the rules of war. The mainstream media is following the official line, content to limit the focus to Hamas terrorism, Israel's right of self-defense, and Israel's intelligence failure, rather than offer some perspective on motivations and consequences. Forgotten are the impoverishment of Gaza, the abandonment of the Palestinian cause by the Arab states, and the latest round of dispossession of Palestinian lands under the far-right Israeli government. Among the many questions that arise from events of the last few days are these two. First, Hamas has given the far-right Israeli government a gift of sorts. Netanyahu can now become the wartime prime minister, unifying the country and forcing protesters of his so-called judicial reform, such as army veterans, to come to the aid of their country. Will the war be the end of the protests, or will Netanyahu be blamed for inciting the attacks and failing to prevent them? Second, the hostage situation poses a very difficult challenge for the Israeli government, since it involves military as well as civilian captives. The price tag for their release will be high indeed. Is the government willing to pay the price, or will possibly hundreds more die? Or will Israel's all-out attack on Gaza lead to executions of hostages, as Hamas is threatening? No matter the answers, we're witnessing a tragedy of appalling dimensions. The horrific violence needs to be condemned on both sides in a search for peace, but few sources are interested in moving in that direction. In other news, the world's largest salmon fishery is endangered. The governor of Alaska is asking the Supreme Court to overturn an EPA ruling that forbids operation of the Canadian-owned Pebble Mine in Alaska. Mining would have severely adverse consequences for the world's leading salmon grounds. Opposition to the Pebble Mine is across the board. Indian tribes, environmental groups, the fishing industry. The governor stands in the uncomfortable position of being an advocate for a Canadian mine, against the wishes of the Alaskan public. Chinese food imports from Japan dropped dramatically. China is out to punish Japan for releasing low-level radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. China is Japan's principal market for food and other agricultural products. In the past month, those Japanese exports to China have dropped over 40% compared with a year ago. The Japanese government is providing some financial relief to fishers, but not enough to offset their losses. It's a diplomatic issue now, as Japan considers taking the case against China before the World Trade Organization on the argument that no dangerous radioactivity has been recorded on fish from the Fukushima area. They have support from some Asian neighbors. Thailand, for instance, says it has found food from the area are perfectly okay. But the Chinese have a point. In a recent article in the journal Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Tatsujiro Suzuki, a Japanese nuclear engineer and former vice chair of Japan's Atomic Energy Commission, argues that release of contaminated water from Fukushima should stop. He points to flaws in the way the Tokyo Electric Power Company presents its case for safe, that is to say treated water, that is released into the Pacific. Suzuki's recommendations include restoring public trust and confidence. The government should first stop the water release and task an independent oversight organization which can be trusted by stakeholders, and then make a final decision about the plan after studies confirm that the release has had no significant impact on the ocean environment and fish, unquote. In short, the Fukushima story is not over. China's aggressive diplomacy. China is well known for brash, wolf warrior diplomacy. No better example is a warning that the Chinese delegation to the United Nations put out last month to all UN members not to attend a UN hearing on China's genocidal policies in Xinjiang province. Adopting the usual line that foreign interference in China's internal affairs is unacceptable, especially when it comes to human rights issues, the notice to members said the Chinese mission, quote, has the honor to express our resolute opposition to this event and strongly recommend your mission not to participate in this anti-China event, quote, unquote. The Chinese delegation harshly criticized two NGOs that helped organize the event, the Atlantic Council and Human Rights Watch, calling them, quote, notorious anti-China organizations. They are obsessed with fabricating lies and are plotting to use human rights issues as a political tool to undermine Xinjiang's stability and disrupt China's peaceful development, unquote. This stability and development have come at a high cost to Uyghurs and other Chinese Muslims. By now, a mountain of evidence points to a systematic effort by the Beijing leadership to efface a minority group's identity, push them into forced labor, separate families, and carry out other policies that fit with the international understanding of genocide. Yet the Chinese delegation repeated the absurd official view that, quote, the current situation in Xinjiang is at its best in history, with social stability, high-quality economic growth, full victory in poverty alleviation, notable improvement in people's livelihood, greater solidarity among all ethnic groups, and harmony among different religions. A pandemic treaty? I have a hunch that few of us are aware that an international treaty is under discussion on pandemic preparedness and prevention. Sponsored by the World Health Organization, the draft treaty, unveiled in February, will attempt to correct some of the worst features of the international reaction to COVID-19. Those include the pharmaceutical industry's withholding of vaccines, poor delivery to developing countries, China's refusal to share data, and the unfulfilled hopes of a global vaccine distribution scheme called COVAX. Let's recall that COVID-19 killed roughly 7 million people and cost the global economy more than $12 trillion. As is common with international treaties, however, this one doesn't hold parties to account and lacks clarity on how it would be implemented among the nearly 200 national parties. Right now, discussions of the treaty are deadlocked, with no progress on the most important issue, equity in the distribution of knowledge and product. That issue rubs up against the vaccine manufacturers' intellectual property rights, which the US and the European Union are seeking to protect. It seems that it's too much to ask that the vaccine producers and their governments make a binding commitment to share their research so that poor countries can produce their own drug. Japan opens its doors to asylum seekers. Japan is one of the most closed societies when it comes to refugees and other foreigners seeking permanent entry. But a new law that will take effect December 1 will permit asylum seekers from Ukraine, the Middle East, and elsewhere to have permanent residency and work under a status equivalent to that of refugees. That's quite a change considering that last year, Japan allowed in about 5% of people who applied for refugee status. There are about 2,500 Ukrainians in Japan now, a paltry number considering the hundreds of thousands who have escaped the war to European countries. Finally, a Senate committee blocks military aid to Egypt. The Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, led by Democrat Ben Cardin of Maryland, will block $235 million in military aid to Egypt, citing the Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's regime, consistent violations of human rights. Senator Cardin also said he would seek to prohibit future military aid and arms sales if Egypt, quote, does not take concrete, meaningful, and sustainable steps to improve human rights conditions. That's a particularly noteworthy move since President Biden previously issued a national security waiver on human rights conditions and agreed to send Egypt all but $85 million of the military aid package. Under U.S. law, military aid is conditional on recipients protecting freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly, allowing independent media, civil society, and human rights defenders to function without interference, and releasing political prisoners and providing detainees with due process of law. Egypt is guilty on all counts, yet receives about $1.6 billion a year in U.S. aid. Now both houses of Congress have spoken. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Mel Gertov. Take good care.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to Cable News In Depth. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson recently completed his first 100 days in office, and various reporters and commentators have been trying to assess how the new mayor is doing. In these times, spoke with a number of elected officials, movement leaders, and political strategists, as well as Johnson himself, to get a sense of how much has been done so far to create a more equitable Chicago. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with In These Times reporter Taylor Moore about Mayor Johnson's first 100 days.
The first 100 days, is that a fair time to assess someone's performance, or is it just kind of standard? Is it just kind of a tradition that people adhere to?
Yeah, it is. The 100 days is considered like a pretty traditional benchmark for understanding how, you know, we expect a public official to govern their leadership style, what relationships they're making, what policies they're prioritizing. You know, it's very different campaigning than governing, but it's also when thinking about a candidate like Mayor Brandon Johnson. It is interesting to think about the 100-day benchmark because a lot of his policies and a lot of his vision for the city is focused on eradicating the systemic racism and discrimination in the city. And you know, that took generations to put into place. So it will take, and many of my sources know that it will take longer than 100 days, a year, a term to reverse a lot of this damage.
So he had a plan to reduce crime. It was a jobs program, is that right? How's that going?
Yeah, so he did launch a youth employment program this summer. I don't have any of the figures in front of me to tell how many jobs were created, but that is something that's very central to his plan to combat violence, is to increase youth employment so that teens are able to, you know, access more opportunities and see a future for themselves that many can't, living in impoverished neighborhoods.
Had anything like that been attempted by Chicago city authorities before? I'm trying to think of past mayors. If you go back a long ways, someone like Harold Washington?
Yeah, there have been youth employment programs that the city has run for, I think, decades now. I think the difference is with Mayor Johnson is that he's made this a centerpiece of his public safety plan, is to address the root causes of violence rather than, for example, increasing the police budget, which is already soared to $1.9 billion.
The Chicago Police Department hasn't always had the best reputation. How is he getting along with them, or what's his attitude toward them?
Yeah, it's been pretty congenial. At the beginning of the year, during the campaign season, the police union president, John Catanzara, had threatened mass resignations among Chicago police officers if Brandon Johnson were to win. He said that there would be blood in the streets if he won, but that really hasn't been the case. In fact, we've seen, you know, Johnson be praised for, I guess, in some ways, building bridges with police or trying to improve, you know, community police relations. He's appointed to the role of police superintendent Larry Snelling, who's a longtime Chicago police officer, and he is pretty well respected in the force. And there hasn't been a lot of pushback there, but by and large, no, there hasn't been the mass resignations that people have been threatening.
How about his plan to help the homeless or to help resolve that issue? Did that have to do with a real estate tax?
Yes.
How's that going?
It seems to be making progress. So last year, that plan, which is under the banner of the Bring Chicago Home Coalition. So it's a plan to increase the real estate transfer tax for homes worth more than $1 million. And that would be a dedicated revenue stream for anti-homelessness initiatives, for, you know, for housing, for shelters. And the city response to the homelessness has been really, for decades, has been piecemeal, but also hostile to the unhoused. So with this plan, under the previous mayor, Lori Lightfoot, she had signaled interest in increasing the real estate transfer tax for this reason, but then ended up going back on her promise. And many organizers and city council members think that she also blocked the measure from seeing the light of day in city council. But right now, it seems that there's been some forward progress. Just a couple weeks ago, Mayor Johnson and the coalition behind this policy announced that they had come up with a compromise plan where actually most home buyers would see a reduction in their the tax for real estate under $1 million, and then the tax percentage would increase by a larger percent for homes worth $1 million. So they made a progressive tax structure where, you know, most people buying homes should actually see less in taxes.
So I take it the real estate people are not happy about this, is that right?
Oh no, they're not happy, of course. And you know, they're saying that this discourages landlords and encourages landlords to pass on the extra costs to to tenants. They're saying it discourages companies and you know, wealthier people from owning property in the city of Chicago, which I don't know if will be the case.
What kind of coverage is Mayor Johnson getting in the local media?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of detailed coverage about him. I think from the past 100 days, it seems that he's very optimistic and is making progress on some of his key plans, but is also facing a lot of significant challenges and has come under fire for some of his appointments. For example, firing the Chicago Department of Public Health Commissioner Allison Arwady, who with the previous mayor, Lightfoot, was the face of the city's coronavirus pandemic response, and she was fired over what seems to be like some pretty key policy differences between Arwady and Johnson. But the way in which she was fired got a lot of pushback. And there's also been a lot of coverage about the administration's handling of the migrant crisis happening now. You know, since last August, the governors of southern states in Texas and Florida have been, you know, passing the buck on their responsibility to take care of asylum seekers. So they've been busing people to sanctuary cities and in other states that would have said they'd be more welcoming to immigrants. But this has also, you know, caused a crisis in Chicago and some other cities where the city and the city of Chicago and then the state of Illinois haven't gotten federal aid to be able to take care of the more than 13,000 people that have come into Chicago through the buses. And I know that Mayor Johnson has recently called on President Joe Biden to expedite the work permits so that you know, the people who have newly arrived here can work and can support themselves outside of being in these shelters or even just like sleeping on the floors of police stations, which has been happening the past several months.
So as far as you can tell, does the term of Mayor Johnson so far bode well for progressive politics in Chicago?
Yeah, and I think so.
By extension in the country, that you can have a progressive mayor, have a successful term?
I'd say so. Yeah, I think there has been some criticism that, you know, some things have been slow going with appointing commissioners to top spots or not fulfilling campaign promises within the 100 days, like you said, on the campaign. But I think there's been a lot of forward movement on some of the policies that have been really important to both him and to his coalition members. For example, a plan to dispatch social workers and EMTs to 911 calls of over, you know, homelessness and mental health crises rather than cops. You know, that like I mentioned before, the plan to fund anti-homelessness initiatives through, you know, taxing sales of $1 million properties. I think that's all seeing some really forward movement in the organizers, the movement leaders that I talked to are all very optimistic. Another plan that's in place is increasing the minimum wage for tipped workers. Right now it's about $6 lower than the current minimum wage, which is around $15. So I know that one of the key priorities for city council for this fall is to increase that wage so workers aren't relying on the, you know, the largesse of whoever they're serving.
So you don't see anything like, say, the campaign waged against Dennis Kucinich years ago when he was mayor of Cleveland to get rid of him? There's no major opposition like that in Chicago.
No, not from what I can tell. I think the Johnson administration has been praised for how they've worked with the movement leaders who have gotten them elected, but also with the sectors that didn't get him elected, like the business sector or the police. I think he's also received some praise from those groups that weren't key on him before. So I think it remains to be seen now if there will be some sort of revolt. But I think people are generally pretty optimistic and are hoping that he is accountable to the folks that put him into office, which hasn't been necessarily the case, for example, with the former mayor Lightfoot.
Anything else you want to add to what you've said?
I'd say that there's a lot of really interesting ideas that Johnson's team around him, not the actual administration, but the people who elected him, they released a over 200-page transition report that detailed a lot of policies that some of them more pie in the sky, but others are, you know, but like, I guess like one could say pie in the sky, but also some of them are really genuinely radical and would be really, you know, progressive if put into place, like things like universal child care, reparations for descendants of enslaved Black people, a public bank to address the lack of access to loans in marginalized communities, guaranteed college funding for kids born in Chicago. A lot of really big ideas that, if you know, if they're implemented, they could be a playbook for progressive movements nationally.
That was In These Times reporter Taylor Moore speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson's first 100 days. If you like stories like this, consider supporting KABU during our fall membership drive. You can do so at kabu.fm/give. A special thank you to some of our most recent donors, to anonymous folks Benjamin N., Phil R., and Peter P. Thanks for your support, kabu.fm/give, or you can text KABU to 44321. For KABU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for Rose City Native Radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi-yo, hi-yo.
Due to technical problems, the Old Mall Variety Hour Indigenous People's Day special did not air on Monday, October 9. Instead, we will be airing the program next Monday, October 16 at 9 a.m. Join the Moles to hear stories, poetry, and commentary on efforts to decolonize and reclaim Indigenous ways of being. Music by Fawn Wood.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The financial